Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Up until the 1920s, the average New Yorker ate as many as 600 local oysters a year. Back then, Americans ate twice as much fish and shellfish per capita. Butcher meat was more scarce, and much of the nation's protein came from its 94,000 miles of coastline and 3.5 million acres of rivers. Today, 91% of the seafood Americans consume comes from abroad, and yet a third of the fish and shellfish caught here is exported. Paul Greenberg makes a case for reviving America's local fisheries and production in his book, American Catch: The Fight for Our Local Seafood. The book follows the rise and the fall and attempts to revitalize production of the New York oyster, the Gulf shrimp, and the Alaskan wild sockeye salmon. Paul Greenberg will be reading and speaking at a reception tonight at the Red Door in Portsmouth. And Paul Greenberg, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
You chose these three species, the New York oyster, the Gulf shrimp, wild sockeye salmon, to illustrate different facets of America's fish and seafood supply. Now, why these three, and what do they represent?
Well, what I really wanted to talk about in this book was ecological infrastructure. In other words, the things that you need to have abundant seafood. And each one of them is kind of a part for the whole, a kind of representation of a particular kind of infrastructure that we've lost in this country. When we look at New York oysters, for example, oysters, as you mentioned at the top of the show, used to be a staple of American eating habits. And along with that, once upon a time, this country was replete in wild oyster reefs. And wild oyster reefs do a lot of really amazing things. They filter the water. The average oyster can filter about 50 gallons of water per individual per year. So in a country that had quadrillions of them, you can imagine how much cleaner the water was. But they also create structure and environment. And some of my research has shown that the presence of a functional oyster reef can actually double the amount of seafood carrying capacity that you would have in nearshore waters.
Hmm.
So that was one, you know, infrastructure thing. The next thing was really looking at shrimp and particularly in the Gulf of Mexico. And there the question was salt marsh. Salt marsh is the most productive form of, you know, ecosystem that there is out there in terms of energy production or food production. Something like 10 times more carbon is fixed by a salt marsh than a tropical rainforest. And lo and behold, shrimp are, you know, vitally interconnected with salt marshes. And lo and behold, we've lost 60 to 70% of our salt marsh in the last, you know, 100 odd years. So there's that. And then finally, with sockeye salmon, what I was really talking about was the interface between rivers and oceans. This is a key ecological moment. And once upon a time in this country, shad, herring, sturgeon, salmon, these were all the backbones of our seafood diet, and they all depended on free-flowing rivers. But if you look at places like New Hampshire, for example, we have thousands upon thousands, if not millions, of small-scale dams. I often, when I do a PowerPoint presentation, show a map of the state of Connecticut with all these dots on it. And those dots actually represent the 3,000 dams in the state of Connecticut alone.
Wow.
I often say this is why people in Connecticut are so uptight. Their chi is blocked by all those dams. But, I mean, you have them in New Hampshire as well. You have them in Massachusetts. They're everywhere. And we need to really think about this ecological infrastructure if we want to have more seafood on our plates.
Well, let's dig into one of the species you look at in the book, Gulf Coast shrimp. Shrimp, by far, the most consumed seafood in America. Yet the wild shrimp market in the Gulf Coast has been undercut by what you call the red lobster commodity model. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I often say I call shrimp sometimes the Manchurian crustacean in that once upon a time when we were first starting to ramp up our shrimp economy, and this was in the 30s and 40s and 50s, people saw it as a specialty item, as a, you know, something that you eat locally in a kind of Cajun environment, for example. But once these chain seafood stores like Red Lobster, like Long John Silver's, got people into the habit of eating a lot of shrimp, we soon found that we just didn't have enough shrimp to meet capacity. And that's where we started looking abroad to other Asian primarily to Asian shrimp fisheries, and not just fisheries, but to aquaculture. Shrimp had never really been domesticated in any large-scale way before the 1950s, say. But in the 1950s, in the 1960s, in the 1970s, you saw this incredible research and development effort, mostly in Southeast Asia, to tame first the tiger prawn and then the Pacific white leg shrimp. And now 90% of the shrimp eaten in this country are imported, and half of those are farmed, and most of those farmed shrimp are coming to us from Southeast Asia.
So cheaper coming from halfway around the world. And this is one of those distortions, it seems, of the global supply chain, which we read about in the case of at least some Alaskan salmon that you write about. Can you trace that route from ocean to plate for Alaskan sockeye salmon?
Unfortunately, it's true of a lot of seafood in this country that we can't seem to process it and eat it in the place that we catch it. There are so many different players involved. And so you take the example of, say, sockeye salmon and a lot of Alaska salmon in general. About 80% of the salmon caught in Alaska are exported. But a certain portion of them, sockeye among them, are frozen right there at the river mouths where they're caught. They are sent via sea freight to China. They're defrosted, boned and filleted, refrozen, and then sent back to the United States twice frozen. It's just this thing that seems to be prevalent. It's prevalent in the squid industry. It exists in the Alaska pollock industry. And what I've actually found out lately in talking, you know, as American catch has kind of gotten out around the world, people are writing to me in England and Scotland, and they're saying, geez, you know, the same thing's happening to us. You know, you always hear about shortages of North Sea cod, you know, as one of the drivers in overfishing. Well, turns out a certain amount of North Sea cod is getting frozen, you know, in the North Sea and sent to China, defrosted, frozen again, and sent back.
How can the economics of that possibly work? I can't.
Well, you know, a lot of it has to do with very cheap labor. In China and Thailand and other Asian countries. So that's the primary driver. And the other thing which the California Wet Fish Association, the people who harvest squid, sardines, and anchovies told me was that it's actually quite energy efficient to freeze and then ship across the oceans and then defrost and send back. Shipping things by sea freight is not that, you know, energy intensive. But on the other hand, you know, I think the Wet Fish Association took issue with me for bringing that up because, you know, they were saying, well, the carbon footprint is actually quite low. But I wasn't really talking about carbon footprint. In fact, the phrase I used is food miles. And food miles is really inclusive of a whole set of questions. When you export your processing to another country and you outsource it and you dismantle your own ability to process your own seafood, you're diminishing your own system. You're outsourcing your food sovereignty to another nation. So the question I'm putting out there is, yeah, it might be cheaper to send things abroad for processing, but is it better in the long run for our sense of food security to have another country deal with our own fish?
Act locally, buy milk and vegetables locally. How about fishing locally? Paul Greenberg is with us. His new book, American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood, makes a case for reviving local aquaculture. He's optimistic about the nation's ability to rebuild the infrastructure to support local fishing. Well, I wonder why you are, Paul, because any discussion of food production gets framed in this global market. You know, what's the scale that we have to operate to make it worth it? Where's our customer base? With fishing, it's right. Also policy, like the Clean Water Act you mentioned, and laws about pollutants, restrictions on overfishing, and the soaring prices of coastal property. So where do you even begin with this rebuilding of the infrastructure?
I guess if I were going to say, let's try to rebuild America's seafood infrastructure, let's start with the bottom up. If we're going to do aquaculture, let's do shellfish aquaculture. Let's farm mussels, clams, oysters, and also edible seaweeds, for example. Edible seaweeds, by the way, you know, more than 90% of the ones that we eat are coming to us again from abroad. If we were to start an aquaculture system based on bivalves and seaweed, this would do great things for cleaning the water. It doesn't require any outside sources of feed. It creates structure and habitat for other fish. So this is like a win-win-win situation. As far as getting over the question of whether or not shellfish farmers could have access to local waterfront. Well, that's a policy situation right there. I mean, I think we have to, as we start talking about ocean zoning and ocean planning, we have to make sure that adequate places are allowed on the coast for people who are actually producing food for us. It shouldn't just become a luxury recreation sector, the coast. When you talk about fishing, yeah, when you're talking about New England, you know, there are very serious shortfalls when it comes to cod. I mean, the recent release by National Marine Fisheries Service that, you know, the Gulf of Maine cod stocks are not rebuilding, that they do seem to be in bad shape. You know, other ground fish, maybe not so bad. But here's a case where I think we need to move out of the kind of commodity way of looking at fish. I don't think that, you know, commodification of cod didn't do anything very good for cod, and it didn't do anything very good for humans. Turning it into a sort of faceless slab of fish that you fry and put in a fish stick or put on a bun, I don't think is a good way to use what's fairly sensitive life out there. So I think we need to think about broadening our palate, embracing more species out there. I mean, I think there in the Northeast, you do have an overabundance of things like dogfish sharks, which, you know, can be eaten. Down here in our neck of the woods, we have, you know, an overabundance of a fish called a sea robin, which, again, is perfectly edible. But Americans are so sort of, you know, fixed in their ways about what makes a good and edible piece of fish that we're over-relying on things like cod and pushing the system too hard for things like cod when we really should be broadening our palate.
But talking about this book with people in a very unscientific way, the most frequent comment I heard from people was that they don't know what to buy. What is it? Are we supposed to buy tilapia or no? Or is pollock good? I mean, how do we know?
It depends what you're looking for. But if you're trying to, with a minimum of pollutants and maximum of omega-3s, there are a set of creatures you can be on the lookout for. Mussels, number one, very high in omega-3s, very low in toxins, very, very, very good for the environment, requires no outside feed source, filters the water. I mean, what could be better than a mussel, really? And it's delicious. I just had a delicious 2 pounds of them we went through with my family, and it was, you know, very affordable as well. So mussels are way, way atop my list. Next thing to consider, which is something I think the consumer in New England has to push for a little bit, is herring. You know, a great deal of the herring catch that comes in into Maine, New Hampshire, is actually ends up being used as lobster bait. When, in fact, herring is very high in omega-3s, again, low in toxins, a delicious piece of fish, but we don't seem to want to eat it locally.
But these are very big hurdles to get over. You're talking about consumer taste. You're talking about consumer habits. And, you know, this is here in New England where fishing fed and built economies for centuries, and now we feel very disconnected from us. So, so how do you make the case, Paul Greenberg? You know, why should we concern ourselves about copper mines in Alaska if salmon is still in the supermarket?
Well, I mean, that harkens back to the last chapter of my book where, in fact, in Alaska, which Alaska in many ways resembles, from a fisheries perspective, what New England was 200 years ago, abundant codfish, abundant pollock, abundant salmon. And presently, the same sort of infrastructure threats that tore apart the fishing economy of New England are facing Alaska. In Alaska right now, for example, there is on the books an idea to put in what would be the largest copper and gold mine in North America, right at the headwaters of what is the largest sockeye salmon run left in the world, a run of about 40 million fish that comes into Bristol Bay, Alaska, every year. Why is this even being considered? Well, I argue a little bit in the book that partly it's being considered because Americans are so dissociated from those sockeye salmon, with a great majority of them going abroad, they don't even see it as part of their food security. So yes, it is a little bit of a stretch to ask Americans to seek out local seafood, to seek out American seafood. But I do believe that if we can close that loop, then we have the chance to say, look, this is our food and this is the system that allows this food to exist. If we don't integrate consumption with environmental protection, then I think that we're going to lose a lot more coastal viability, and we're even going to lose, you know, these real seafood engines of the country like Alaska.
Paul Greenberg, I want to thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Paul Greenberg, author of American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. We previously spoke to him about his best-selling book, Four Fish. He's in Portsmouth, New Hampshire tonight at a reception sponsored by River Run Books. It's at the Red Door and it's at 5 o'clock. You'll find more information at wordofmouthradio.org.